Hello everyone, this is a lecture on common carriers in general, and we start with the definition and the essential elements. That's where we stopped last meeting, and as we said, Article 1732 defines common carriers as persons. Common carriers are persons, corporations, firms, or associations engaged in the business of carrying or transporting passengers or goods, or both, by land, water, or air, for compensation, offering their services to the public. So remember, it's not public service, but offering their services to the public. So the contract of transportation is defined as a contract of transportation is one whereby a certain person or association of persons obligate themselves to transport persons, things, or news from one place to another for a fixed price. So there's compensation, there's transportation, and offering of services to the public. And classification of transportation as to object could be things, transport of things, transport of persons, or transport of news. So you can classify transportation as to its object, things, persons, or news. You can also classify transportation as to the place of travel or what is being traveled upon, or the medium. Or it could be by land, by water, or air. So again, transportation can be classified as to object and place of travel. As to object, we have things, persons, and news. And as to place of travel, we have land, water, or air. Who are the parties to contract of transportation? There are three. Number one is the shipper or consigner. Number two, the carrier or conductor. Number three is the consignee. The shipper or consignor is the person to be transported, one who gives either the one to be transported or one who gives rise to the contract of transportation by agreeing to deliver the things or news to be transported, or to present his own person or those of other or others in the case of transportation of passengers. The second party to a contract of transportation is the carrier or conductor. One is one who binds himself to transport persons, things, or news, as the case may be. One employed in or engaged in the business of carrying goods or for the other for hire. That's a carrier or a conductor. The third party to a contract of transportation is the consignee. The consignee is the party to whom the carrier is to deliver the things being transported. One to whom the carrier may lawfully make delivery in accordance with its contract of carriage. But the shipper and the consignee may be one person. Remember that. So the shipper and the consignee may be one and the same person. The first and the third party may be one and the same person. How do you define freight? Freight. The terms has been defined as, a freight is defined as the price or compensation paid for the transportation of goods by a carrier at sea from port to port. But the term is also used to denote the hire paid for the carriage of goods on land from place to place or on inland streams or lakes. The name is also applied to the goods or merchandise transported at sea, on land, or inland streams or lakes. Thus, the term is used in two senses. The term freight in two senses, to designate the price for the carriage or the price for transportation, also called freightage, or to designate the goods carriage. It could be the price or the goods. So when you say freight, it could be the price you pay for the transportation, or it could be the goods being transported. That is to designate the goods or carriage. So when you use the word freight or freight, as the case may be, you are referring to two senses. So freight could be price or the goods to be transported. That's freight. Contracts through transportation agents. A contract of transportation is not changed, altered, or affected by the mere fact that the obligor avails of other parties to effect the transportation agreed upon, as in the case of transportation agents. So whether or not you use transportation agents, the contracts are the same. So it's not changed. The nature is the same. Carriers, as we've said, are defined as the person or corporations who undertake to transport or convey or transport goods, property, or persons from one place to another gratuitously or for hire, and are classified as private or special charters or carriers and common or public carriers. So private as opposed to common carriers. So private carriers are those who transport or undertake to transport in a particular instance for hire or reward. So let's differentiate between a common carrier vis-a-vis the private carrier. The common carrier holds himself out in common, that is, to all persons who choose to employ him as ready to carry for hire. No one can be a common carrier unless he has held himself out to the public as a carrier in such a manner as to render him liable to an action if he should refuse to carry for anyone who wished to employ him. However, on the contrary, a private carrier agrees in some special case with some private individual to carry for hire. Okay, so that's clear. Common carrier, private carrier. Common carrier, you are holding out yourself in common to all persons who choose to employ you. And you should hold yourself out to the public as a carrier in such a manner as to make you liable in case you carry, if you refuse to carry someone or anyone who wish to employ him. Well, the private carrier agrees in some special case with some private individual to carry for hire. Another difference of a common carrier and a private carrier is that a common carrier is bound to carry all who offer such goods as it is accustomed to carry and tender reasonable compensation for carrying them. While a private carrier is not bound to carry for any reason unless it enter into agreement, a special agreement to do so. So again, with respect to common carriers, a common carrier is bound to carry all who offer such goods as it is accustomed to carry and tender reasonable compensation for carrying them, while a private carrier is not bound to carry for any reason unless it enter into a special agreement to do so. So that the second difference between the common and the private carrier. The third difference is that a common carrier is a public service and is therefore subject to regulation. Okay? So a common carrier is a public service and is therefore subject to regulation. While a private carrier is not, a private carrier does not hold itself out as engage in the business for the public and is therefore not subject to regulation as a common carrier. So again, a private carrier does not hold itself out as engage in the business for the public and is therefore not subject to regulation as a common carrier. But of course, it is subject to another regulation, but not as a common carrier. So those are at least three differences between a common carrier and a private carrier. So remember, a common carrier is a public service. When you say it's a public service, it goes back to our first meeting when we discuss what is public service, at least the definition of public service, which you will soon learn from in the other podcast about the public service, as in the introductory lectures we have on public service. So it's important that to know if it's a common, acting as a common or private carrier, you should know the definition or what is meant by a public service, because a common carrier is a public service, while a private carrier does not hold itself out as engaged in the business for the public and is therefore not subject to regulation as a common carrier. So what are the tests for a common carrier? So what are the tests? How would you know that if the transportation or the carrier you are employing, you have employed is acting as a common carrier? So what are the steps? Number one, he must be engaged in the business of carrying goods for others as a public employment. And again, public employment, engaged in that business, and must hold himself out as ready to engage in the transportation of goods or for persons generally as a business and not as casual occupations. It's the business, it's general, it's ordinary, and not just a special or casual occupation. So again, the first test is that the carrier must be engaged in the business of carrying goods for others as a public employment and must hold himself out as ready to engage in the transportation of goods for persons generally as a business and not a casual occupation. The second test is that he must undertake to carry goods of the kind to which his business is confined. He must undertake to carry goods of the kind to which his business is confined. The third test is that he must undertake to carry by the methods by which his business is conducted and over his established roads. So again, he must undertake to carry by the methods by which his business is conducted and over his established roads. The fourth test is that the transportation must be for hire. So the transportation must be for hire. So therefore, the true test is whether the given undertaking is a part of the business engaged in by the carrier, which he has held out to the general public as his occupation, rather than the quantity or extent of the business actually transacted, or the number and character of the conveyances used in the employment. So the test is therefore the character of the business actually carried on by the carrier. So again, I repeat, the true test is whether the given undertaking is a part of the business engaged in by the carrier, which he has held out to the general public as his occupation. Remember, as his occupation, and rather than the quantity or extent of the business actually transacted, or the number and character of the conveyances used in the employment. In short, the test is the character of the business actually carried on by the carrier. So for example, an airplane owner is a common carrier where he undertakes for hire to carry all persons who apply for passage indiscriminately as long as there is room and no legal excuse for refusing. Airlines engage in the passenger service on regular schedules on definite routes who solicit patronage of the traveling public, advertise schedules for routes, times of leaving and rates of fare, and makes the usual stipulation as to baggage are, therefore, common carrier. So, that's an example on an airplane. So, what then are the characteristics of common carriers? So, what are the characteristics of common carriers? Number one, the common carrier undertakes to carry for all people indifferently. He holds himself out as ready to engage in the transportation of goods for hire as a public employment and not as a casual occupation, and he undertakes to carry for all persons indifferently within the limits of his capacity and the sphere of the business required of him, so that he is bound to serve all who apply and is liable for refusal without sufficient reason to do so. So since that's business and he had held himself out as offering the service, he could be held liable if he refused to render that service if that refusal is without reason. The second characteristic of a common carrier is that the common carrier cannot lawfully decline to accept a particular class of goods for carriage to the prejudice of the traffic in those goods. So, the second characteristic is that the common carrier cannot lawfully decline to accept a particular class of goods for carriage to the prejudice of the traffic in those goods. But there's an exception. For some sufficient reason, where the discrimination in such goods is reasonable and necessary. So, there should be a substantial ground for the refusal or to decline to accept a particular class of goods. So again, the second characteristic, the common carrier cannot lawfully decline to accept a particular class of goods for carriage for the prejudice of the traffic in those goods. except that for some sufficient reason, for the discrimination in such goods is reasonable and necessary, or there should be substantial grounds for the refusal. The third is characteristic of common carriers is that there should be no monopoly. That is, no monopoly is favored, because the Public Service Commission has the power to say what is a reasonable compensation to the utility and to make reasonable rules and regulations for the convenience of the traveling public and to enforce them. So it's subject to regulation. And number four is of characteristic of public of a common carrier is that it is for public convenience. That is, for the best interest of the public. So that's the four characteristics of a common carrier. So what do you mean by public use? It is not confined, public use is not confined to privileged individuals, but is open to the indefinite public. There must be a right which the law compels the owner to give to the general public. Public use is not synonymous with public interest. The true test or criteria or criterion is whether the public may enjoy it by right or only by permission. So that's the true test. It is confined to privileged individuals. It is not confined to privileged individuals, but is open to the indefinite public. There must be a right which the law compels the owner to give to the general public. So that's the true criteria, the true test, whether the public may enjoy it by right or only by permission. As you would know, the law prohibits unreasonable discrimination by common carriers. The law requires common carriers to carry for all persons, either passengers or property, for exactly the same charge for a like or contemporaneous service in the transportation of the like kind of traffic under substantially similar circumstances or conditions. The law prohibits common carriers from subjecting any person or locality or any kind of traffic to any undue or unreasonable prejudice or discrimination whatsoever. The exception is that when the actual cost of handling and transporting is different, then different rates may be charged. Cases that merchandise of like quantity may not be considered alike. The quantity, kind, and quality may be exactly the same and yet not be alike, so far as the cost of transportation is concerned. Again, for example, merchandise of like quantity may not be considered alike. The quantity, kind, and quality may be exactly the same and yet not be alike, so far as the cost of transportation is concerned. And second example is that shipments may be alike although composed of different classes of merchandise. Difference in the charge for handling and transporting may only be made when the difference is based upon actual cost. So again, it's based on actual cost. Okay, so what are the determination? So how do you determine if the refusal is justifiable? How do you know that the refusal by the common carrier to transport you is justifiable? This involves a consideration of the following factors. Number one, suitability of the vessels to the company for the transportation of such products. Number two, reasonable possibility of danger or disaster resulting from their transportation in the form and under conditions in which they are offered for carriage. Number three, the general nature of the business done by the carrier. And number four, all the attendant circumstances which might affect the question of reasonable necessity for the refusal by the carrier to undertake the transportation of this class or merchandise. So how do you determine justifiable if the refusal is justifiable? So you would consider the following four factors: the suitability of the vessels of the company for the transportation of such products. Number two, the reasonable possibility of danger or disaster resulting from the transportation. Number three, the general nature of the business done by the carrier. And number four, all the attendant circumstances which might affect the question of the reasonable necessity for the refusal by the carrier to undertake the transportation of this class of merchandise. Case in point is that the mere fact that the carriage of dynamite may lead to destructive explosions is not sufficient to justify refusal if it can be proven, if it can be proven that in the condition in which it is offered for carriage, there is no real danger to the carrier, no reasonable ground to fear that the vessel and those on board will be exposed to unnecessary or unreasonable risk. So, a clear example would be the mere fact that that you carry dynamite or you want to transport dynamite may lead to destructive explosion is not sufficient to justify refusal. If you can show that the condition it is offered for carriage, there's no real danger, as in you will pack it very tightly or its safeguards are used to make to avoid any explosion. There's a case of U.S. versus Tanpiaco. U.S. versus Tanpiaco, 40 Philippines 853. Tanpiaco rented two automobile trucks, and was using them upon the highways of Leyte for the purpose of carrying some passengers and cargoes. He carried passengers and cargoes under a special contract in each case and had not held himself out to carry all passengers and cargo for all persons who might offer passengers and cargo. Tanpiaco was convicted for violation of public utility law for operating a public utility without permission from the Public Utility Commission. So the issue in this case is whether or not defendant operated a public utility, and the answer is no, the defendant did not operate a public utility. There is no public use. The trucks were used under the special agreements to carry particular persons and property. Remember that the public service law at the time, two things are necessary. The individual co-partnership must be a public utility, and two, the business in which such individual co-partnership is engaged must be for public use. Public use means the same as use by the public. The essential feature of public use is that it is not confined to privileged individuals, but is open to the indefinite public. In determining whether a use is public, we must look not only to the character of the business to be done, but also to the proposed mode of doing it. If the use is merely optional to the owners, or the public benefit is merely incidental, it is not public use, authorizing the exercise of the jurisdiction of the Public Utility Commission. There must be, in general, a right which the law compels the owner to give to the general public. It is not enough that the general prosperity of the public is promoted. Public use is not synonymous with public interest. The true criterion, as I've said, the true criterion by which to judge the character of the use is whether the public may enjoy it by right or only by permission. So that's the Tanpiaco case. There's another case, it's the Home Insurance Company versus American Steamship Agencies. Home Insurance versus American Steamship Agencies, 23 Scra 24. In this case, a Peruvian firm, a fish meal through S.S. Scarborough, consigned to the SNB and insured by the Home Insurance Company. The cargo arrived with shortages. SMB demanded and Home Insurance Company paid 14,000 pesos in settlement of SMB's claim. Home Insurance filed for recovery from Luzon Stevedoring and American Steamship Agencies. Luzon Stevedoring claimed that it merely delivered what it received from the carrier in the same condition it received it. American Steamship contended that it was not liable because of a stipulation in the charter party that the charterer, not the ship owner, was to be liable for any loss or damage to the cargo. The CFI, or the Court of First Instance, absolved Luzon Stevedoring but ordered American Steamship to reimburse the $14,000 to Home Insurance, declaring that Article 587 of the Code of Commerce makes the ship agent civilly liable for damages in favor of third persons due to the conduct of carrier's captain, and that the stipulation in the charter party exempting the owner from liability is against public policy under Article 1744 of the Civil Code. The issue in this case is whether or not the stipulation is valid, and the answer, yes, the stipulation is valid. The provisions of our Civil Code on common carriers, the court ruled, were taken from the Anglo-American law. Under American jurisprudence, a common carrier undertakes to carry a special cargo or chartered to a special person only, becomes a private carrier. Again, under American jurisprudence, a common carrier undertaking to carry a special cargo or chartered to a special person only becomes a private carrier. As a private carrier, a stipulation exempting the owner from liability for the negligence of its agents is not against public policy and is deemed valid. So remember, therefore, a public carrier could become a private carrier in some instances. So the Civil Code provisions on common carriers should not be applied where the carrier is not acting as such but as a private carrier. The stipulation in the charter party absolving the owner from liability for loss due to the negligence of the agent would be void only if the strict public policy governing the Civil Code is applied. Such policy has no force where the public at large is not involved, as in the case of a ship totally chartered, like in this case, for the use of a single party. Based on the stipulation, recovery cannot be had for loss or damage to the cargo against the ship owners unless the same is due to the personal acts or negligence of the said owner or its managers, as distinguished from agents or employees, and no personal act or negligence has been proved. In a charter of the vessel, of the entire vessel, the bill of lading issued by the master to the charter, a shipper, is in fact and legal contemplation merely a receipt and a document of the title and not a contract, for the contract is the charter party. Again, in a charter of the entire vessel, the bill of lading issued by the master to the charterer as a shipper is in fact and legal contemplation merely a receipt and a document of title, and it is not a contract, for the contract in this case is of course the charter party. Okay, so there's another case, the Guzman versus Court of Appeals, the Guzman versus Court of Appeals, 168 Scra 612, that's the Guzman versus Court of Appeals. Okay, in this case, in the Guzman, Sindana was a junk dealer and was engaged in buying used bottles and scrap of materials in Pangasinan and brought this to Manila for resale. He used 2 6-wheeler trucks. On the trip, in the return trip to Pangasinan, he would load his vehicles with cargo which various merchants wanted delivered to Pangasinan. For that service, he chartered freight lower than regular rates. He charged freightage lower than the regular rates. General Mail Company contracted with him for the hauling of 750 cartons of milk. On the way to Pangasinan, one of the trucks was hijacked by armed men who took with them the truck and its cargo and kidnapped the driver and his helper. So they must be having a party with the milk. Only 150 cartons of milk were delivered. 150, so it's the 600 were being used by the robbers or by the hijackers. So they were having a party with milk. The milk company sued to claim the value of the lost merchandise based on an alleged contract of carriage. Sindana denied that he was a common carrier and contended that he could not be liable for the loss since it was due to force majeure. The trial court ruled that he was a common carrier, but the court of appeals reversed and said, no, the trial court is wrong. He was not a common carrier. So the issue in this case is whether or not Sindana is a common carrier. And the court ruled, yes, Sindana was acting as a common carrier. According to the court, Sindana is properly characterized as a common carrier, even though he merely backhauled goods for other merchants, and even if it was done on a periodic basis rather than on a regular basis, and even if his principal occupation was not the carriage of goods. Article 732 makes no distinction between one whose principal business activity is the carrying of persons or goods or both, and who does such carrying only as an ancillary activity. It also avoids making distinction between a person or enterprise offering transportation services on a regular or scheduled basis and one offering service on an occasional, episodic, or unscheduled basis. Neither does it make a distinction between a carrier offering its service to the general public and one who offers services or solicits business only from a narrow segment of the population. The fact that Sindana does hold a CPC, or a Certificate of Public Convenience, is no excuse to exempt him from incurring liabilities as a common carrier. Otherwise, it would be to reward persons who fail to comply with applicable statutory requirements and would be offensive to public policy. The liability arises the moment a person or firm acts as a common carrier, without regard to whether or not such carrier has also complied with the requirements of the applicable regulatory statute and implementing regulations. Another issue in this case is whether or not Sindana may be held liable for the loss of the milk. The first issue is whether or not Sindana is a common carrier. The answer is yes. Sindana was acting as a common carrier. And the second issue is whether Sindana may be held liable for the loss of the milk. And the answer is no. Sindana may not be held liable for the loss of the milk. According to the court, common carriers, by the very nature of their business and for reasons of public policy, are held to a very high degree of care and diligence, that is, extraordinary diligence, in the carriage of goods as well as passengers. Article 174 establishes the general rule that the common carriers are responsible for the loss, destruction, or deterioration of the goods which they carry, and if the same is due to the causes enumerated therein. Such enumeration is a closed list. Causes falling outside of that list, even if they are force majeure, fall within the scope of Article 1735, which provides that common carriers are presumed to have been at fault or to have acted negligently unless they prove that they observe extraordinary diligence required under Article 1733. However, Article 1745 provides that a common carrier cannot be allowed to divest or diminish his responsibility even for acts of strangers like thieves or robbers, except where such thieves or robbers acted with grave or irresistible threat, violence or force. The limits of extraordinary diligence are reached where there is grave or irresistible threat, violence or force. In this case, the loss was quite beyond the control of the common carrier. Even common carriers are not made absolute insurers against all risks of travel and of transport of goods, and are not liable for acts or events which cannot be foreseen or are inevitable, provided that they shall have complied with the rigorous standard of extraordinary diligence. So hence, he cannot be held liable for the loss. There's another case here. It's the case of Planters Products versus CA, GR 1010503, September 15, 1993. And the issue in the case of Planters Products versus Sea is whether or not does a charter party between a ship owner and a charterer transform a common carrier into a private one as to negate the civil law presumption of negligence in the case of loss or damage to its cargo. And of course, the answer is no. In this case, Planters purchased urea fertilizer from Mitsubishi New York. The fertilizer was shipped on MV San Plum, which is owned by KKKK, from Alaska to San Fernando, La Union. A time charter party was entered into between Mitsubishi as shipper charter and KKKK as ship owner. Upon arrival in the port, PPI unloaded the cargo. It took PPI 11 days to unload the cargo. PPI hired a marine and cargo surveyor to determine if there was any shortage. A shortage and contamination of the fertilizer was discovered. PPI then sent a claim letter to SSA, the resident agent of KKK, for the amount of the loss. An action for damages was filed. SSA, the resident agent of KKK, contended that the provisions on common carrier do not apply to them because they have become private carriers by reason of the charter party. The trial court awarded damages. The court of appeals reversed. Again, as I've said, the issue is whether or not a charter party between a ship owner and charterer transform a common carrier into a private one as to negate the civil law presumption of negligence in case of loss or damage to its cargo. And the answer is no. A charter party is a contract by which an entire ship or some principal part thereof is let by the owner to another person for a specified time or use. There are two kinds. One, contract of affreightment, which involves the use of shipping, space, or vessels leased by the owner in part or as a whole to carry goods for others. The second one is charter by demise or bareboat charter, where the whole vessel is let to the charterer with a transfer to him of its entire command and possession and consequent control over its navigation, including the master and the crew who are his servants. So the first one is contract of affreightment. The second one is just a bareboat charter. Bareboat charter, everything is given to the charterer. While the contract of affreightment is just involves the use of a particular space, while the bareboat charter is the whole boat is given to the charterer. So it is not in this case it is not disputed that the carrier operates as a common carrier in the ordinary course of business. When PPI chartered the vessel, the ship captain, its officers and crew were under the employ of the ship owner and therefore continued to be under its direct supervision and control. Thus, it continued to be a public carrier. It is therefore imperative that a public carrier shall remain as such, notwithstanding the charter of the whole or portion of the vessel, provided the charter is limited to the ship only, as in the case of a time charter or a voyage charter. It is only when the charter includes both the vessel and the crew, as in the bareboat charter or demise, that a CC or common carrier becomes private insofar as such particular voyage is concerned. So again, there are two types of charter party. The first one is contract of affreightment, which is just a use of the shipping space, and second is charter by demise or bareboat charter. So there's a transformation of a common carrier into private charter in the case of the second type of charter party. In this case, there is no transformation because it's the first type of charter party. It's the contract of affreightment. It's just a lease of the shipping space. Contract of affreightment. The first type. The second question is whether or not, the second issue is whether or not the carrier is liable for the damages. And the answer is no. The carrier is not liable for damages. The presumption, because according to the court, the presumption of negligence on the part of the respondent carrier has been overcome by the showing of extraordinary zeal and assiduity exercised by the carrier in the case of the cargo. On the other hand, no proof was adduced by the petitioner showing that the carrier was remiss in the exercise of due diligence in order to minimize the loss or damage to the goods it carried. How about this case of Coastwise Lightbridge Corporation versus CA, GR number 114167, July 12, 1995. Coastwise Lightbridge versus CA, the issue in this case is about Pag-asa Sales Incorporated entering into a contract to transport molasses from Negros to Manila with Coastwise using the latter's dam barges. The barges were towed in tandem by the tugboat MT Marcia, which is likewise owned by the Coastwise. Upon reaching Manila Bay, while approaching Pier 18, one of the barges, Coastwise 9, struck an unknown sunken object. The forward buoyancy compartment was damaged and water gushed in through the hole 2 inches wide and 22 inches long. As a consequence, the molasses of the cargo tanks were contaminated and rendered unfit for the use it was intended. This prompted the consignee, Pag-asa, to reject the shipment of the molasses as total loss. Thereafter, Pag-asa filed a formal claim with the insurer of its cargo, the private respondent Philippine General Insurance Company, or PhilGen, and against the carrier, the petitioner, Coastwise. Coastwise denied the claim, and it was PhilGen which paid the consignee the amount of 700,000, representing the value of the damaged cargo of the molasses. In turn, PhilGen filed an action against Coastwise before RTC Manila, seeking to recover the 700,000 it paid to Pag-asa. The RTC, the Regional Trial Court, ruled in favor of PhilGen. The Court of Appeals affirmed the RTC, and hence the petition filed by Coastwise Lightbridge. The court ruled that the bareboat charter and contract of affreightment under the bareboat charter of the vessel, the charter will generally be regarded as the owner of the voyage or service stipulated. The charterer mans the vessel with his own people and becomes the owner, pro hac vice, subject to liability to others for damages caused by negligence. To create a bareboat charter, the owner of a vessel must completely and exclusively relinquish possession, command and navigation of the charterer. Anything short of such complete transfer is a contract of affreightment. That's what we call time or voyage charter party. Just a lease of a shipping space. And it's not a charter party at all. A contract of affreightment, as opposed to bareboat charter, as we have discussed before, is one which the owner of the vessel leases part or all of its space to transport goods for others. It is a contract for special service to be rendered by the owner of the vessel, and under such contract, the general owner retains the possession, command, and navigation of the ships, the charterer or freighterer merely having use of the space in the vessel in return for his payment of the charter hire. Although a charter party may transform a common carrier into a private one, the same, however, is not true in contract of affreightment on account of the aforementioned distinctions between the two. In this case, the petitioner, Coastwise, admits that the contract is entered into with the consignee. Was only a contract of affreightment. However, it is not true in a contract of affreightment on account of how the petitioner admits that the contract is entered into with the consignee was one of affreightment. According to the court, Pag-asa only leased three petitioners' vessels in order to carry cargo from one point to another, but the possession, command, and navigation of the vessel remained with the petitioner or Coastwise. Hence, a petitioner is liable for breach of contract of carriage, having failed to overcome the presumption of negligence with the loss and destruction of goods it transported by proof of its existence and of extraordinary diligence. So the mere proof of delivery of goods to a carrier and the subsequent arrival of the same goods at the place of destination in bad order makes for a prima facie case against the carrier. The patron of the vessel, Coastwise 9, admitted that he was not licensed. This is a violation of the rule in the Code of Commerce, Article 609, which requires that patrons must have the legal capacity to contract in accordance with this code. The Code of Commerce and prove the skill, capacity, and qualifications necessary to command and direct the vessel and must be qualified for the discharge of the duties of the first position. Coastwise cannot safely claim to have extraordinary diligence by placing a person whose navigational skills are questionable at the helm of the vessel which eventually met the accident. Had the patron been licensed, he could have been presumed to have both the skill and the knowledge that would have been prevented the vessels hitting the sunken derelict ship that lay on their way to Pier Number 8. Okay, so that's the case of Coastwise and Philogen. So let's go to the nature of business, the power of the state to regulate the common carrier. It's under Article 1765, Article 1765 on the nature of business and the power of the state to regulate the common carriers. So Article 1765, the Public Service Commission, as the Board of Transportation, may on its own motion or on petition of any interested party after due hearing cancel the certificate of public convenience granted to any common carrier that repeatedly fails to comply with his or its duty to observe extraordinary diligence as prescribed in this section, which is Article 1765. So again, it's as we have repeatedly said, common carriers are subject to legislative regulation. The business of a common carrier holds such a particular relation to the public interest that there is superinduced upon it the right of public regulation. The business of a common carrier is affected with public interest. Hence, therefore, one devotes his property to a use in which the public has an interest. He, in effect, grants to the public an interest in that use and must submit to be controlled by the public for the common good to the extent of the interest he has thus created. So it's subject to legislative regulation. But there are limitations on the part to regulate. Such regulations must not have the effect of depriving an owner of his property without due process of law, nor of confiscating or appropriating private property without due just compensation, nor of limiting or prescribing irrevocably vested rights or privileges lawfully acquired under a charter or franchise. So, limitation is just compensation and due process of law. And when judiciary may interfere with legislative regulation of common carriers, the courts ought not to interfere, may not interfere with legislative regulations unless they are so plainly and palpably unreasonable as to make their enforcement equivalent to the taking of property for public use without such compensation, as under all circumstances is just both to the owner and to the public. So an example here will be the case of Pantranco versus PSC or the Public Service Commission. And Pantranco has been engaged for the past 20 years in the business of transporting passengers by means of motor vehicles in accordance with CPCN issued to it. It filed with the PSC, the Public Service Commission, an application for authorization to operate 10 additional new trucks. The application was granted with two conditions: that the CPCN would be valid for only 25 years, and two, that the service can be acquired by the government upon payment of cost price of its useful equipment, less reasonable depreciation. Pantranco challenged the constitutionality of Article 15 of Commonwealth Act 146 as undue delegation of legislative powers. Hence, the issue in this case, whether or not the Public Service Commission may prescribe the two conditions as a prerequisite to the issuance of the Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity. The court held, yes, the CA 146 provides a sufficient standard, which is public interest, by which the PSC is guided in imposing such condition. The business of a common carrier, according to the court, holds such a particular relation to the public interest that there is superinduced upon it the right of public regulation. When private property is affected with public interest, it ceases to be iure privati only. When therefore one devotes his property to a use in which the public has an interest, he in effect grants to the public an interest in that use, and must submit to be controlled by the public for the common good to the extent of the interest he has thus created. He may withdraw his grant by continuing the use, but so long as he maintains the use, he must submit to the control. Indeed, this right is so far beyond question that it is settled that the power of the state to exercise legislative control over public utilities may be exercised through the Board of Commissioners. This right of the state to regulate public utilities is founded upon the police power of the state, and statutes for the control and regulation of utilities are a legitimate exercise thereof for the protection of the public as well as the utilities themselves. Such statutes are not unconstitutional, either as impairing the obligation of contracts, taking property without due process, or denying the equal protection of the laws, especially inasmuch as the question of whether or not private property shall be devoted to a public use and the consequent burdens assumed is ordinarily for the owner to decide. And if the owner voluntarily places his property in public service, he cannot complain that it becomes subject to the regulatory powers of the state. This is more so in the light of authorities which hold that a certificate of public convenience constitutes neither a franchise nor a contract, confers no property rights, and is a mere license or privilege. So CPC is merely a mere license or privilege. So what now is the nature and basis of liability of a common carrier? So what is the nature and basis of liability of the common carrier? And the answer to that question, the nature and basis of liability of the common carrier, is all in Articles 1733 and 1734, 1735, 1745, 1755, and 1566. So 1756. So the nature and basis of liability is in Article 1733 and discusses 1734, 1735, 1745, 1755, 1756. 1733 provides that common carriers, from the nature of their business and for reasons of public policy, are bound to observe extraordinary diligence in the vigilance over the goods and for the safety of the passengers transported by them according to the circumstances of each case. Such extraordinary diligence in the vigilance over the goods is further expressed in Articles 1734, 35, 45, numbers 5, 6, and 7, while the extraordinary diligence for the safety of the passengers is further set forth in Articles 1755 and 1756. So, 1734, let's see, 1734, 35, and 45 for over the goods. 1734, common carriers are responsible for the loss, destruction, or deterioration of the goods unless the same is due to any of the following causes only: flood, storm, earthquake, lightning, or other natural disaster or calamity. Number 2, act of the public enemy in war, whether international or civil. Number 3, act or omission of the shipper or owner of the goods. Number 4, the character of the goods or defects in the packaging of or in the containers. And number 5, order or act of competent authority. So it's about the extraordinary diligence for the safety of the goods, over the goods. And 1744 and 1735, in all cases other than those mentioned in numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 of the preceding article, meaning 1734, if the goods are lost, destroyed, or deteriorated, common carriers are presumed to have been at fault or to have acted negligently unless they prove that they observed extraordinary diligence as required in Article 1733. So that's 1733. So remember, 1733 is the standard, which is extraordinary diligence, which is common carriers for the nature of their business and for reasons of public policy, quote, are bound to observe extraordinary diligence in the vigilance over the goods and for the safety of the passengers transported by them according to the circumstances of each case. 1745, any of the following or similar stipulations shall be considered unreasonable, unjust, and contrary to public policy. Number 5, that a common carrier shall not be responsible for the acts or omissions of his or his employees. Number 6, that a common carrier's liability for acts committed by thieves or of robbers who do not act with grave or irresistible threat, violence or force is dispensed with or diminished. Number 7, that a common carrier is not responsible for the loss, destruction or deterioration of goods on account of the defective condition of the car, vehicle, ship, airplane or other equipment used in the contract of carriage. 1755, with respect to the safety of passengers, provides that a common carrier is bound to carry the passengers safely as far as human care and foresight can provide, using the utmost diligence of very cautious persons with a due regard for all circumstances. Again, 1755, with respect to extraordinary diligence for the safety of passengers, provides a common carrier is bound to carry the passengers safely as far as human care and foresight can provide, using the utmost diligence of very cautious persons with a due regard for all circumstances. And 1756, still with respect to extraordinary diligence for the safety of the passengers, provided in case of death of or injuries to passengers, common carriers are presumed to have been at fault or to have acted negligently unless they prove that they observe extraordinary diligence as prescribed in Articles 1733 and 1755. So what is the extraordinary diligence required of common carriers? The law requires common carriers to exercise extraordinary diligence, which means that they must render service with the greatest skill and utmost foresight. The extraordinary diligence required of carriers in the handling of the goods of the shippers and consignees lasts from the time the cargoes are loaded in the vessels until they are discharged and delivered to the consignees. The reasons for requiring extraordinary diligence that the nature of the business of common carriers and the existence of public policy demand that they observe extraordinary diligence. The business of common carriers is impressed with a special public duty and therefore subject to control and regulation by the state. The public must of necessity rely on the care and skill of common carriers in the vigilance over the goods and safety of the passengers. The rigorous law on common carriers not applicable to special employment as carriers. So the laws applicable to common carriers are strict and should not be extended to a person who has neither expressly assumed that character, nor by his conduct and from the nature of his business justified the belief on the part of the public that he intended to assume it. So since the laws applicable to common carriers are strict, it should not be extended to a person who has neither expressly assumed that character, nor by his conduct and from the nature of his business justified the belief on the part of the public that he intended to assume it. How about the registered owner primarily and solidarily liable with driver under the cabin system? Registered owners is primarily and solidarily liable for the damage caused by the vehicle registered in his name, even if the said vehicle had already been sold, leased, transferred to another person who was at the time of the accident actually operating the vehicle. The operator of record continues to be the operator of the vehicle in contemplation of law as regards the public and third persons, and as such is responsible for the consequences incident to its operation. Such owner operator of record is held in contemplation of law as the employer of the driver. What is the cabit system? One whereby a person who has been granted a certificate of public convenience allows other persons who owns vehicles to operate them under such license for a fee or percentage of the earnings. This is contrary to public policy and therefore void and inexistent. This is a pernicious system that cannot be too severely condemned. It constitutes an imposition upon the good faith of the government, the cabit system. And what's the reason for holding the registered owner liable? The law does not relieve the registered owner directly of the responsibility that the law fixes and places upon him as an incident or consequence of registration. Where a registered owner allowed to evade responsibility by proving who the supposed transferee or owner is, it would be easy for him by collusion with others or otherwise to escape said responsibility and transfer the same to an indefinite person or to one who possesses no property with which to respond financially for the damage or injury done. In case of an accident, the registered owner should not be allowed to disprove his ownership to the prejudice of the person injured or to be relieved from responsibility. There's one case, the Kanko versus MRR case, 38 Philippines 768. Kanko versus MRR. Jose Kanko, an employee of MRR, was riding on a train. As it drew up to the station, the plaintiff made his exit. As he alighted, his foot stepped on a sack of watermelons, causing him to slip, and his right arm was crushed. This happened between 7 and 8 p.m., and as the railroad station was lighted dimly by a single light, objects on the platform were difficult to see. The issue in this case is whether or not MRR is liable to pay damages for the acts of its employees. The answer is yes. It cannot be doubted that the employees of the railroad company were guilty of negligence in piling sacks on the platform. Their presence constituted an effective legal cause of the injuries sustained by Kanko. It is important to note that the foundation of the legal liability of the defendant is the contract of carriage, and that the obligation to respond for the damage which plaintiff has suffered arises, if at all, from the breach of that contract by reason of the failure of defendant to exercise due care in its performance. Its liability is direct and immediate, that is culpa contractual, differing essentially from that presumptive responsibility for the negligence of its servants, which can be rebutted by proof of the existence of due care in the selection and supervision of employees, or culpa aquiliano. The liability of masters and employers for the negligent acts or omissions of their servants or agents, when such acts or omissions cause damage which amount to the breach of a contract, is not based upon a mere presumption of the master's negligence in their selection or control, and proof of exercise of utmost diligence and care in this regard does not relieve the master of his liability for the breach of his contract. Remember that when the facts averred show a contractual undertaking by the defendant for the benefit of the plaintiff and is alleged that plaintiff has failed or refused to perform the contract, it is not necessary for plaintiff to specify in his pleadings whether the breach of the contract is due to the willful fault or to negligence on the part of the defendant or of his servants or agents. Proof of the contract and of the non-performance is sufficient prima facie to warrant recovery. The contract of defendant to transport plaintiff carried with it, by implication, the duty to carry him in safety and to provide safe means of entering and leaving its range. That duty, being contractual, was direct and immediate, and its non-performance could not be excused by proof that the fault was morally imputable to defendant's servants. So that's the case of Kanko versus MMR. Another case is Medina versus Crescentia. The sole issue in this case is whether or not Crescentia is liable for breach of contract of carriage, and the answer is yes. Crescentia is liable for the breach of contract of carriage. According to the court, the law requires the approval of the PSC in order that a franchise or any privilege pertaining thereto may be sold or leased without infringing the certificate issued to the grantee, and that if property covered by the franchise is transferred or leased without this requisite approval, the transfer is not binding against the public or the PSC. And in contemplation of law, the grantee of record continues to be responsible under the franchise in relation to the PSC and to the public. Since a franchise is personal in nature, any transfer or lease thereof should be notified to the PSC so that the latter may take proper safeguards to protect the interests of the public. The plaintiff's action is based on the breach of the carrier's contractual obligation It carries passengers safely to their destination. That is culpa contractual. The liability of the carrier is direct and immediate. So that's the case of Medina versus Christian. In that case, remember, a passenger jeepney driven by Brigido Aborque smashed into a Meralco post, resulting in the death of Vicenta Medina, one of his passengers. In a criminal case of homicide through reckless imprudence, Aborque pleaded guilty, the driver. The right to file a separate action for damages was reserved. Crescentia was still the registered operator of the jeepney in the records of the Motor Vehicles Office and the PEC, while Rosario Aborque was the owner at the time of the accident. So Crescentia was made liable for the breach of the contract. Another case is Isaac versus EL Amin Trans Company, 101 Philippines 1046. The issue in this case is whether or not the defendant observed extraordinary diligence or the utmost diligence of a very cautious person in avoiding the collision. The answer is yes. In this case, plaintiff boarded the defendant's bus as a paying passenger from Albay. The bus collided with a pickup truck which was coming from the opposite direction trying to swerve from a pile of gravel. As a result, his left arm was completely severed. Plaintiff chose to hold defendant liable on its contractual obligation. Plaintiff brought this action for damages which the lower court dismissed, holding the driver of the pickup negligent and not that of the bus. So as we've said, the defendant observed the extraordinary diligence or the utmost diligence of a very cautious person in avoiding the collision in this case. According to the court, the facts of the case show that the bus and the pickup were approaching in each other head-on. The bus swerved to the right and went over a pile of stones and gravel. Despite the efforts of the bus driver, the pickup car still hit the rear left side of the bus. The sense of caution one should observe cannot always be expected from one who is placed suddenly in a predicament where he is not given enough time to take the proper course of action under ordinary circumstances. And furthermore, according to the court, the plaintiff is guilty of contributory negligence since he placed his left elbow outside the window. According to the court, again, a common carrier is bound to carry the passengers safely as far as human care and foresight can provide, using the utmost diligence of very cautious persons with due regard for all circumstances. This extraordinary diligence required of common carriers is calculated to protect the passengers from the tragic mishaps that frequently occur in connection with rapid modern transportation. This high standard of care is imperatively demanded by the preciousness of human life and by the consideration that every person must in every way be safeguarded against all injury. Principles as to liability of common carriers. Number one, the liability of a common carrier is contractual and arises upon breach of its obligation. There is breach of its if it fails to exert extraordinary diligence according to all the circumstances of each case. Number two, a carrier is obliged to carry its passenger with the utmost diligence of a very cautious person, having due regard for all circumstances. Remember, utmost diligence, very cautious person, due regard for all circumstances. Number three, principle of liability of common carriers. A carrier is presumed to have been at fault or to have acted negligently in case of death of or injury to passengers, it being duty to provide that it exercised extraordinary diligence. So its duty is to prove that it exercised extraordinary diligence. And the fourth principle as to the liability of common carriers is that the carrier is not an insurer against all risk of trouble. So if you're the common carrier, this is your defense, that the carrier is not an insurer against all risk of trouble. The next case is Flores versus Miranda. That's 105 Philippines 266. Flores versus Miranda. In this case, the issue is whether or not the approval of the PSC is necessary for the sale of a public service vehicle, even without conveying therein the authority to operate the same. And the answer is yes, the approval is necessary for the sale of public service vehicle, even without conveying therewith the authority to operate the same. A transfer made, according to the court, a transfer made without the requisite approval of the PSC is not effective and binding insofar as the responsibility of the grantee under the franchise in relation to the public is concerned. the law was designed primarily for the protection of the public interest. Another issue is whether or not moral damages may be awarded. In this case, in case of breach of contract, including one of transportation, proof of bad faith or fraud, that is wanton or deliberately injurious of conduct, is essential to justify an award of moral damages. The exception to this is when the mishap results in the death of a passenger, in which a civil carrier is liable to pay, a common carrier is liable to pay moral damages for the mental anguish by reason of the death of the passenger. So where the injured passenger does not die, moral damages are not recoverable unless it is proved that the carrier was guilty of malice or bad faith. Under the law, the presumption is that the common carrier acted negligently but not maliciously. The distinction between fraud, bad faith, or malice in the sense of deliberate or wanton wrongdoing and negligence as mere carelessness is too fundamental in our law to be ignored. A carrier's bad faith is not to be lightly inferred from mere finding that the contract was breached through negligence of the carrier's employees. Okay? So the next case is the Philippine Rabbit Bus Lines versus Intermediate Appellate Court. That's 189 SCRA 159. Philippine Rabbit Bus Lines versus IAC 189 SCRA 159. The issue is who should be held liable, the Mangunis and Filters Guarantee Assurance Corporation, the insurance company. So who is liable? In this case, the Mangunis or the insurance company. In this case, the court had occasion to state about the principle of last clear chance. According to the court, the principle of last clear chance would call for application in a suit between the owners and drivers of two colliding vehicles. It does not arise where a passenger demands responsibility from the carrier to enforce its contractual obligations, for it would be inequitable to exempt the negligent driver of the jeepney and its owners on the ground that the other driver was likewise guilty of negligence. So in this case, several passengers boarded the jeepney owned by the spouses Manguni and driven by Manalo and Dao, by Manalo at Dao, Pampanga, bound for Carmen Rosales, Pangasinan. Their contract with Manalo was 24 pesos for the trip. Upon reaching Tarlac, the right wheel of the jeepney was detached, so it was running in an unbalanced position. Manalo stepped on the brake, making a sudden U-turn in an unbalanced position and encroaching on the right of way of the other vehicles. The Philippine Rabbit Bus bumped from behind the jeepney. As a result of the collision, three persons died while the others sustained injuries. Cases were filed against the spouses Manguni, Manalo, the driver, and Philippine Rabbit, and the Los Reyes, the driver. So in this case, as we said, the principle of last clear chance does not apply in this case because it does not arise where a passenger demands responsibility from a carrier to enforce a contractual obligation. And the presumption that the driver who bumped the rear of another vehicle are guilty and the cause of the accident, unless contradicted by other evidence, the Supreme Court held that the jeep made a sudden U-turn, which was so abrupt that the other driver, De Los Reyes, did not anticipate the sudden U-turn. The proximate cause of the accident was the negligence of Manalo and the driver and the spouses Manguni. In culpa contractual, the carrier is presumed to have been at fault or to have acted negligently, and this is disputable. This disputable presumption may only be overcome by evidence that he had observed extraordinary diligence or that the death of injury of the passenger was due to a fortuitous event. The driver cannot be held jointly liable with the owners of a jeep in case of breach of the contract of carriage. The contract of carriage is between the carrier and the passenger, and in the event of a contractual liability, the carrier is exclusively responsible, therefore, to the passenger. Even if such breach be due to the negligence of the driver, to make the driver jointly liable would make the carrier's liability personal instead of merely vicarious, and consequently, the victim is entitled to recover only the share which corresponds to the driver. And the next is about the fourth topic is the classes of common carriers. So what are the classes of common carriers? 1732. Common carriers are persons, corporations, firms, or associations engaged in the business of carrying, transporting passengers, of goods or both, by land, water, or air for compensation, offering their service to the public. Article 173, common carriers, from the nature of their business and for reasons of public policy, are bound to observe extraordinary diligence in the vigilance over the goods and for the safety of the passengers transported by them according to the circumstances of each case. Such extraordinary diligence in the vigilance over the goods is further expressed in Article 734, 35, 45, number 567, while extraordinary diligence for the safety of the passengers is further set forth in Articles 1755 and 1756. Under Article 1755, a common carrier is bound to carry the passengers safely as far as human care and foresight can provide, using the utmost diligence of very cautious persons with a due regard for all circumstances. So there's common carriage of goods, common carriage of passengers through land, through water, through air. And the laws applicable in common carriage is Article 1766. 1766 provides that in all matters not regulated by the Civil Code, the rights and obligations of common carriers shall be governed by the Code of Commerce and by special laws. So the provisions of the Civil Code, that's Article 1732 to 1766, primarily govern common carriers, and the provisions of the Code of Commerce, that's overland transportation and maritime commerce, and special laws, which is the Carriage of Goods by Sea Act, the Salvage Act, the Civil Aviation Code Act, have only subsidiary application to common carriers. Under Article 17, remember the Civil Code provisions of common carriers 1732-1766. These are just 30 provisions, 1732-1766. Remember, 1732-1766, so just around 30 provisions. So under Article 1753 of the Civil Code, the law of the country to which the goods are to be transported shall govern the liability of the common carrier for their loss, destruction, or deterioration. So, with respect to the applicable law, remember 1753, the law of the country to which the goods are to be transported shall govern the liability of the common carrier for their loss, destruction, or deterioration. The provisions of the Civil Code primarily govern contracts of carriage of goods from foreign ports to Philippine ports. So in this case, we have an example. This is Eastern Shipping Lines versus IAC 150/463. Eastern Shipping Lines versus IAC 150/463. And the issues is that, number one, which law should govern, the Civil Code or the Carriage of Goods by Sea Act? Number two, who has the burden of proof to show the negligence of the carrier? In this case, with respect to the first question, which law should govern, the Civil Code or the Carriage of Goods by Sea Act? Eastern Shipping Lines versus IAC provides a rule that the law of the country to which the goods are to be transported governs the liability of the common carrier in case of their loss, destruction, or deterioration. If the cargoes in question were transported from Japan to the Philippines, the liability of the petitioner carrier is governed primarily by the Civil Code. However, in all matters not regulated by the Code, the rights and obligations of common carriers shall be governed by the Code of Commerce and special laws. Thus, Carriage of Goods by Sea Act or CUGSA, Carriage of Goods by Sea Act or CUGSA, a special law, is supplementary to the provisions of the Civil Code. Second question, who has the burden of proof to show negligence of the carrier? Answer is under the Civil Code. Number two question, common carriers, from the nature of their business and for reasons of public policy, are bound to observe extraordinary diligence in the vigilance over the goods according to all the circumstances of each case. The common carriers are responsible for the loss, destruction, deterioration of the goods unless the same is due to any of the following causes only. That's 1734. Number one, flood, storm, earthquake, lightning, or other natural disaster or calamity. The carrier claims that the loss of the vessel by fire exempts it from liability under the phrase natural disaster or calamity. However, according to the court, we are of the opinion that fire may not be considered a natural disaster or calamity. This must be so as it arises from invariably from some act of man or by human means. It does not fall in the category of an act of God unless caused by lightning or by other natural disaster or calamity. It may even be caused by the actual fault of the or privity of the carrier. As the peril of fire is not contemplated within the exceptions in Article 1734, then Article 1735 provides that in all cases other than those mentioned in Article 1734, the common carrier shall be presumed to have been at fault or to have acted negligently, unless it proves that it has observed the extraordinary diligence required by law. In this case, the respective insurers as subrogees of the cargo shippers have proven that the transported goods have been lost. Petitioner carrier has also proven that the loss was caused by fire. The burden then is upon petitioner carrier to prove that it has exercised the extraordinary diligence required by law. Having failed to discharge the burden of proving that it had exercised the extraordinary diligence required by law, petitioner carrier cannot escape liability for the loss of the cargo. And even if the fire were to be considered a natural disaster within the meaning of Article 1734, it is required under Article 1739 of the same code that the natural disaster must have been the proximate and only cause of the loss, and that the carrier has exercised due diligence to prevent or minimize the loss before, during, or after occurrence of the disaster. This petitioner, the petitioner carrier, has also failed to establish satisfactorily, and the petitioner carrier cannot also seek refuge from liability under the CUGSA or Carriage of Goods by Sea Act, because it is provided with the CUGSA provides that under Section 4.2, neither the carrier nor the ship shall be responsible for loss or damage arising or resulting from B, fire, unless caused by the actual fault or privity of the carrier. In this case, both the trial court and the Court of Appeals in effect found as a fact that there was actual fault of the carrier shown by the lack of diligence, in that when the smoke was noticed, the fire was already big, and that the fire must have started 24 hours before the same was noticed, and that after the cargoes were stored in the hatches, no regular inspection was made as to their condition during the voyage. The foregoing would show that the circumstances under which the fire originated and spread are such as to show that the petitioner carrier or its servants were negligent in connection therewith. Consequently, the complete defense afforded by the Carriage of Goods by SEAC or COGSA when the loss results from fire is unavailing to petitioner carrier. So again, the two issues in the case of Eastern Shipping Line versus IEC, number one, which law should govern, civil code or the Carriage of Goods by SEAC? And number two, who has the burden of proof to show negligence of the carrier? It's answered in Eastern Shipping. In this case, remember these two cases, both for the recovery of value of insurance, arose from the same incident, the sinking of the Asiatica when it caught fire, resulting in the total loss of the ship and cargo. In the first case, MS Asiatica, a vessel operated by petitioner Eastern Shipping Lines, loaded at Japan for transportation to Manila, 5,000 pieces of colorized lance pipes in 28 packages valued at 256,000 consigned to Philippine Blooming Mills, and 7 cases of spare parts valued at 92,261.75 consigned through Central Textile Mills. Both sets of goods were insured against marine drift for their stated value with respondent developed insurance and surety company. In the second case, the same vessel took on board 128 cartons of garment fabrics and accessories in 2 containers consigned to Mariveles Apparel Corporation, and 2 cases of surveying instruments consigned to Aman Enterprises and General Merchandise. The 128 cartons were insured by respondent Nissin Fire and Maritime Insurance Company and Dua Fire and Marine Insurance Company. On its way to Manila, the ship caught fire and sunk. The insurers paid the corresponding marine insurance values and were subrogated to the rights of the latter as the insured. They filed suits against the petitioner carrier and won as affirmed by the Court of Appeals. The petitioner carrier denies liability of the following grounds. Number one, that the loss was due to an extraordinary fortuitous event, which is an exempting circumstance under the Carriage of Goods by Sea Act. And two, that when the fire is established, the burden of proving negligence is shifted to the cargo shipper. So again, we have answered. So that's Eastern Shipping Lines versus IAC. So which law should govern, civil code or the courts or the COGSA? So it only applies supletorily because of special law. So it's primarily governed by the civil code, and COGSA is only a special law, so it's just applied supletorily. And who has the burden of proving to show negligence to the carrier? Of course, as we've said, the carrier has the burden under the civil code from because of the nature of their business and for reasons of public policy are bound to observe extraordinary diligence in the vigilance of goods according to all the circumstances of each case. So that's under Article 173 and 1734. So our next lecture will be, that's our lecture for common carriers in general. So we have discussed their definition, the essential elements of common carriers, and you have the nature of business of common carriers, the power of the state to regulate the nature and basis of their liability of common carriers. And we have discussed under this general heading the classes of common carriers, the laws applicable to common carriers, and we will the next lecture will be on common carriers, which is the liability and presumption of negligence. So watch out for the stay tuned for the next lecture on common carriers. This is not anymore general common carriers, but the liability and presumption of negligence of common carriers. So that's all for our first lecture, for our lecture on common carriers in general.